Welcome to Party Politics. I'm Brandon Rodinghouse, a political science professor from the University of Houston.
And I'm Jay Iyer, a political science professor from Texas Southern University. Thanks for joining us at our favorite hangout, as we do every week, talk a little politics. And as always, Brandon, we've got lots to talk about.
There's a bunch going on,
There's a bunch going on. Just off the top, you know, we've been talking about North Korea a bunch lately. And last week, we talked a lot about how, what's the president going to do? He's got no summit. Well, lo and behold, in very, you know, in the world we live in today, looks like this North Korea summit may in fact come back.
It may be. It looks like they're planning for it. It may not ultimately come. I think the problem for the White House was that they kind of set the sort of stage for it to happen, and then the expectations had increased. And if it doesn't happen, it could be a problem. But to me, it's like one of those chess games, right, that you play that doesn't end, right? Chess is not a game that's going to end quickly. Like, it takes a long time. So the president is still negotiating issues with China, and that's going to have an effect on what happens in North Korea. So there's a lot of these moving pieces that I think we're still uncertain about. And to be honest, I think the White House is uncertain about.
Yeah, I just think that we have to assume that everything the president does in anything is some sort of extended negotiating ploy.
Right.
So when he calls something off, he says something is dead. And as we'll talk about later, when he imposes tariffs just sort of arbitrarily, it's all about negotiations. Speaking of negotiations, the Missouri governor, Eric Greitens, negotiated his way out of a job. Brandon, what happened?
This is a fairly ugly scandal that he has been working through for several months. This was a scandal that had two parts. One part was that he apparently had been involved in a sexual relationship with his former hairdresser. Yes, I said that correctly, former hairdresser. And also, apparently he had taken pictures of her without permission. In addition, prosecutors have got a case against him for misusing his charity's donor list. So it's a fairly interesting scandal. As someone who studies scandals, I find this fascinating because not only, I think, can you expect a certain couple of things to happen from this. First, you can expect to see the next governor likely be a woman, because actually that pattern is fairly scientifically checked out. You also, I think, are likely to see more cooperation with the legislature, because governors who are kind of embroiled in scandals tend to be much more insular. They tend to veto more. And the likelihood is that after that's gone, there's going to be much greater degree of compromise with the legislature.
Yeah, I think the big winner in this is Senator Claire McCaskill. Mm-hmm. She was slated to run against the lieutenant governor at the time. Mm-hmm. And now he is now elevated, becomes the governor. And so she's now got herself a much weaker opponent than she otherwise would have happened. And what was potentially, I think, a pretty strong, likely pickup for Republicans is now a toss-up state, potentially allowing Claire McCaskill to stay, and becomes a Democratic hold. So there's actual real sort of real political implications here.
And you know, actually, the sort of the parties that are affected by these kinds of scandals do tend to suffer at the ballot box. Missouri has had several of these scandals in the past couple of years. There was a redo of a Missouri House race that had suspicious ballots. Had a House member who went to prison. Two speakers of the House in Missouri have gone to prison. So I think this changed the name of the Show Me State to the Show Me the Door State, because that seems to be the where most of these politicians end up.
Well, speaking of doors coming in and out of the country, and we've got I want to call it a scandal. We want to call it something that's gone viral, has been this debate as to what the policy of the United States has been as it relates to children coming both unaccompanied and with parents and entering the United States without documentation. And there's been a lot of coverage about this, and it's created kind of this viral effect as to whether or not the policy that the Trump administration has put in has resulted in lost children, and or whether or not it's resulted in situations where parents are and children are separated. Mm-hmm. What's going on, Brandon? What do we know? And let's separate fact from fiction for people.
Yeah, so the administration put in place what they call a zero tolerance policy that basically cracks down on families who cross the border illegally. The problem is that in terms of holding individuals to be able to process their case, it may require that some of the adults are put in a different place than the children. And because they don't want to put them in the same place, because oftentimes these lockups are not places that you'd want to have children. As it is now, some of the shelters where they keep individuals are almost at full capacity, and the difficulty of trying to find a place for everybody is increasing. So to me, this is a mounting humanitarian crisis that we actually have seen before here in Texas. We saw this a couple of years ago. The response then was primarily military response, and the pivot was to issues with respect to border security. But I don't know that that's really the best approach in this case, because it is going to take an all-encompassing strategy to try to address what is a growing moral crisis.
Yeah, there's sort of two big issues here. There are what we call unaccompanied minors, children that come without any sort of parental support and enter the United States illegally. They have a separate system, and they are assigned through the Office of Refugee Services a foster parent, or for lack of a better word. There was sort of a running scandal about a loss of about 1,500 kids. We just simply could not find them. Hugely problematic. That is one issue, and that has been a problem, I think, for several years.
Mm-hmm. And they may or may not be lost, right?
Yes, and they may not be lost. They just may be out of the system, and they're no longer living with that foster parent. Mm-hmm. The issue now, I think, and that's separate, and there's been some viral photos about it, which really doesn't necessarily apply to the situation we have now, which is the Trump administration, for purposes of creating a deterrent or a counter incentive for people coming here illegally, is separating children from parents. It's never happened before. Didn't happen during the Clinton administration, George W. Bush's administration, or the Obama administration. It's unprecedented. It's been widely condemned, I think, from people on both parties. I'm not sure if it's going to continue. But the long-term issues here, I think, are profound from a humanitarian perspective.
Mm-hmm. Hey, let's talk pardons. The president has a couple of high-profile pardons this week, Jay. What are we talking about, and who's lucky enough to receive them?
Well, pardon number one is a very important one and a good one. Jack Johnson, who is a celebrated boxer in the turn of the century, was wrongly... Galveston Giant was wrongly convicted. Well, certainly convicted at the time of basically marrying someone who was a white woman. He was African-American, which was against the law at the time. A lot of people, a lot of celebrities had joined in. This has been something that's been talked about for a long, long time.
Yeah.
And President Trump, I think, was widely regarded as doing the right thing here. But he just came out with a pardon, pardoning Dinesh D'Souza, a conservative gadfly, lots of controversy around him, made an illegal campaign contribution. And President Trump said he was treated unfairly and decided to pardon him.
Yeah, the original pardon power was given as a way to provide the president to offer acts of mercy. And so typically that's been the case. But it's also been used for these kinds of broader kind of public political interests. And so I think the president is in some way sending a signal. It's clear that in both cases there's a kind of celebrity element to it that I think wouldn't probably get the attention of a president who wasn't Donald Trump, right? Especially in the case of Jack Johnson. Now, part of the reason that other presidents hadn't pardoned Jack Johnson was because there was some controversy about how he treated his wives, and that, I think, didn't sit well with a lot of individuals, especially President Obama, who was asked formally by Congress to make this change. So I don't know that this signals anything broader from President Trump in terms of kind of where he stands in the legal process or redemptive justice. But I do think that the celebrity aspect of both probably gave him an extra incentive to pardon these folks.
Right. And this is coming on the heels of, he just had Kim Kardashian West just came to the White House talking about sentence reform, and in a very similar fashion, sort of pleading for clemency for individuals who have been wrongly convicted or longtime convicted of because of harsh drug sentencing laws, which is a very noble thing. Her father, Robert Kardashian, was a big advocate for sentence reform back in the 90s. And so in that sense,
that was before he was one of OJ's attorneys, right?
Yes, I think it was before he was one of OJ's attorneys. But speaking of sort of the celebrity aspect, we had a kind of bombshell celebrity incident that happened. Roseanne Barr tweeted out some really outrageous and racist things. ABC acted quickly and fired her and canceled the show.
Yeah.
Led to a firestorm and sort of this larger debate of whether or not we reached some sort of tipping point on what's acceptable behavior.
Yeah, and the president involved himself in this by saying that he's glad that Roseanne was given an apology, but he also was owed an apology because ABC had been so rude to him. So he managed to inject himself into this. I didn't watch the reboot of Roseanne. Did you watch any part of the show?
I did. I watched literally the first show, and it was kind of like the old show.
Oh, was it? Okay.
It started off kind of surprisingly good. Reminded me a lot of All in the Family.
Oh, good.
Sort of the reboot.
Yeah, I was thinking that, you know, she needs to act more like Roseanne of like 1990 and not like Archie Bunker of 1970, right? And her tweet clearly was crossed the line and was repugnant. And I think that what ABC did probably showed that there's zero tolerance for this kind of a thing. But I also suggest to me something that was maybe more problematic, and that is that the whole point of these shows and the whole point of this kind of contextualization of these families is to be able to generate some sympathy and to be able to see that we all are similarly affected by the problems of the world, right? We have families that we love, we have friends who we connect to, and if we reduce that to this kind of us versus them mentality, I think it loses the point. So to me, the bigger issue here was that much of this kind of public discourse has been lost or attenuated by the kind of friction and this balkanized politics that we have now.
All right, well, shifting gears very quickly, globally, Ireland had a historic vote repeal their Eighth Amendment ban on abortion. This is our little homage to our dear friend, Edel Howland, who is our former producer. But it's an important vote. One of the things that struck me, Brandon, was that Ireland is one of the rare nations that has used the ballot box to make sort of profound societal policy changes. And it's a bit of a contrast to the way the U.S. does it. They voted for gay rights. They brought in, they allowed abortion rights and voted for the ability to have a divorce, which just all in a span of last five or six years. So sort of tremendous change going on, and we're seeing that globally.
Mm. Hey, speaking of voting, it's not easy being green, Jay, especially here in Texas. It turns out, unfortunately, that the Green Party, along with five other parties, including my favorite party, the None of the Above Party, didn't secure the needed number of valid signatures for ballot access, which means that the Greens will not be automatically on the ballot. The Libertarian Party, though, will. And so that might affect some races, right, where the Libertarian Party may pull some support from Republicans who in some of these districts may be in some jeopardy.
Yeah, you've got about five or six really close House district races, a Libertarian on the ballot. You know, in some of these cases may just affect 100 votes, 200 votes. That might be enough to kind of change the electoral dynamic. And so it's very possible that may have a bigger impact than we think.
I remember in 2006, there was a House race in Austin where the Libertarian on the ballot pulled enough votes from the Republican to shift the seat to the Democrat. So it happens. I mean, not maybe all the time, but you're right that sapping of support could be problematic.
Well, you know what else is happening is hurricane season is upon us.
No.
Exactly. I know.
Didn't we just do that?
I know. We just did it, right? Right.
It's like hockey season. It never seems to end, right? Like for 20 minutes it ends and then it's back.
Well, we are in Houston, Texas here, so we know that we see it more. We've already had our first sort of major storm of the year. But the big question is, in sort of the aftermath of Harvey, how far has the state come? Are you prepared? Has the state really done enough? We know that Harris County is going to have a ballot proposition in August, and Harris County Judge Ed Emmett has organized 23 separate sort of community forums in each of the watersheds around the county, kind of the first time they've ever done that. So it's going to be a big deal moving forward. We know the city has changed some of its regulations, but we're in a new time, kind of the post-Harvey era. Everyone needs to sort of be prepared because hurricanes are a dangerous thing, and it's now a way of life here in the Gulf Coast.
I think we're still in recovery mode and not responsive mode to be able to affect what could be some catastrophic hurricanes. Some predictors suggested there's a 38% chance of at least one major hurricane making landfall. So I don't like those odds, even though it's not quite at 50%. So the city and the region need to be prepared. So personally, get prepared, but let's also watch some of the politics and the policies around this because they're going to be critical to the future of Houston and the region.
Well, Mansfield ISD, a school district not too far here from Houston, suspended a teacher for showing a photograph of their spouse, their same-sex spouse, created an uproar, suspended the teacher with pay, but hasn't assigned them, suggesting that they are promoting some sort of homosexual agenda, I think was the words that they had used. What's going on here, Brandon?
Yeah, so as of now, the contract has been renewed, but it's not clear that she's going to be assigned to the same school. I think that the signal that they're sending is that this is a district and perhaps even a profession that's not tolerant of these kinds of views. And I think that's a problem for trying to recruit and keep good teachers. If you are thinking of being a teacher, it is already a tough enough job that we don't want to have this extra issue. And I don't know, though, that there's going to be any kind of legal recourse for this woman, given the way the laws are written. So I think this is a problem that has to be addressed. The Ledge has tried to address this. The protections for LGBTQ individuals hasn't gone very far in most sessions. So I don't know that, frankly, the politics of this are going to allow it to go any further in the next session.
Yeah. Oftentimes people will ask, why do we need protections like this enshrined in state law? It's almost entirely for incidents like this.
There you go.
Workplace protections still don't exist for LGBTQ citizens. And so as a consequence, there needs to be some sort of change to address these issues.
She's a great teacher, right? She's been voted Teacher of the Year.
She's
twice. Got great reviews. So
it's the kind of thing
that we need to, I think, support, right? And yeah.
Absolutely. Speaking of supporting, Sid Miller, in his attempt to support and condemn, I guess, Roseanne Barr's tweets, did a very Sid Miller thing.
Yeah, it seems like an ever-occurring event where Sid Miller will tweet something or retweet something that is wrong. In this case, he had apparently posted a doctored photo on Facebook that showed Whoopi Goldberg, who's a television personality on, what's that show she's on?
The View.
The View. I know you're a frequent watcher, so you're...
I am.
We schedule the podcast
around
that.
I'm a Whoopi fan. I make no bones about
it. Whoopi's great, right? Anyway, this showed her apparently wearing a t-shirt that depicts Donald Trump shooting himself in the head. It was doctored. It was not correct. A spokesman for Sid Miller says that we post hundreds of these things a week. We put stuff out there, he says in quotes, we're like Fox News. We report and we let the people decide. To me, this isn't the standard we should be shooting for, right?
Yeah, that is the lowest common denominator right there. And it would be funny if it was in fact that Sid Miller does this pretty often. He retweets things that he knows, or at least we find out later, that obviously is fake. And I don't think it seems to bother them, and I'm sure we're going to see more of these.
They need to check Snopes.com before they do this stuff to make sure that they know it's real, right? Because he's a public official, right? He's a politician, yes, but he's also a public official who has official responsibilities, and he represents the state of Texas in all kinds of ways. So he has to clean this up.
Well, what we know is real is a new poll released by Quinnipiac College that essentially says that the race for Texas Senate, U.S. Senate, and the race for Texas governor may not be as close as first thought. I will add that I think this poll and the last poll essentially are saying the same thing. The only thing that's changed is the assumptions of what the turnout is going to be.
Yeah.
The first poll in April that had O'Rourke and Cruz about 3 to 4 points apart, almost in a statistical tie, had an assumption that about the state of Texas electorate would be about +6 Republican, a little bit more Republican than Democrat. This time around, it's about +11 Republican.
Yeah.
And lo and behold, Ted Cruz's lead jumped from 4 to about 11.
I'm having anxiety because I'm thinking back to graduate school and when we did survey sampling. Like, I'm starting to sweat a little bit. But you're exactly right. The fact that they keep changing, like, what the universe of voters looks like, I think is going to give you these differences. I am not so sure that it shows something that's the same. I do think that there's been some movement. I think Greg Abbott's able to define the race a bit better. I think Ted Cruz has really turned it on. And so I do think that you're going to find a kind of robustness in the electorate from the Republicans. But generally speaking, it's a little tough to see what this poll is doing. They don't reveal a lot of things that you would normally reveal in a poll, like the percentage of cell phone that were connected, the Spanish language. I think that for Democrats, though, there's still some problem areas. The first is that Ted Cruz is still beating O'Rourke among Latinos, and that's something which needs to be corrected for them to be able to compete. And the other thing is that there's still a lot of people who don't know who Lupe Valdez or who Beto O'Rourke are. And even though we've had primary and a runoff for one, the fact that that number is still pretty low, I think, is a real issue for where they are in this point in the race with, what, 5 months to go?
Yeah, I sort of take a different tact on it. I think for O'Rourke, it shows a good sign because there's no way that O'Rourke is going to lose the Latino vote to Ted Cruz, mainly because that's not the reality of sort of the way the breakdown was in terms of politics in Texas.
Well, I disagree, though. I mean, look, if it's the case that Abbott runs up the numbers on Valdez and she's not able to communicate effectively, then it's going to hurt O'Rourke's ability to be able to get Latinos
I will bet you a shiner buck that O'Rourke beats Cruz and among Latino voters, largely because Cruz has never performed more than 45%. And so it seems unlikely
good,
that he's going to beat him over 10, which is what the current poll says. So I think that's not a crazy thing. I agree with you on Valdez and Abbott. Abbott certainly, I think, shows his strength and is performing quite well in this poll. And I think you and I both think it's going to be about a 15 to 20 point race, and that seems to be there. Speaking of Greg Abbott, let's take a quick break. And when we come back, let's talk about the big school safety plan that he just announced in response to the tragedy in Santa Fe.
So, Jay, the shooting that took place in Santa Fe, Texas, a weeks ago brought out so much empathy and I think had a lot of people asking hard questions about what to do about it. Greg Abbott put together a series of roundtables that was designed to be able to generate policy issues that might be able to address that in the future. The report that has been produced from that has ticked off a couple of things that are likely to gain some consensus in the legislature. You've got on his list more active shooter training, the expansion of the school marshal program, the early intervention of counselors into the mental health of individuals, some mandatory reporting for lost and stolen guns, as well as a few more things. So the question is this going to be politically profitable for the governor? Is this the kind of thing that can demonstrate some movement in the direction of solving or addressing this issue?
I think it's a really big win for the governor. I mean, just the politics of it. It's a really well thought out and pretty detailed plan that I think attempts to deal with some of the issues coming out of Santa Fe. A couple of things that sort of popped out to me that I think that were really interesting. Number one, I think a lot of the ideas he mentioned have great bipartisan support. Raising the age for certain crimes by children who are 16 and younger, he wants to raise that to 17. We know in this particular case, the individual who shot those kids and teacher in Santa Fe would not have been prosecuted. At least a parent would not have been prosecuted because he was 17 years old. He wants to raise that. He also wants to raise the penalty from a Class A misdemeanor to a third-degree felony, which significantly sort of creates a deterrent effect, and you'll have more prosecutions. He's also talked about a red flag law, which temporarily takes guns away from people that are deemed to be dangerous. Much more intervention when it comes to mental health services. I think where you have those kinds of issues, it really there's a lot of consensus. I still think on the issues of armed marshals, school marshals, basically teachers and other officials on campus, arming them is not particularly popular. We've had that law, but I think he wants to broaden it and make it more easy for people to get it. I think the big question right now is whether he can be convinced to have a special session.
Mm-hmm.
The governor came out and said that unless there's almost unanimous support, he doesn't want to call it. And we recognize the politics of it because it's a special session. The bottom line to me is the governor would be really benefiting not just himself politically, but I think the state as a whole by calling it. And you can imagine the dynamics of doing it. That's all people would be talking about.
See, I take a slightly different tact. I agree that this is better than nothing, and nothing tends to be like the modal approach when it comes to trying to solve this issue or address this issue. But to me, the sort of tepid response about whether or not he would call a special session reflects the fact that maybe there's some serious disconnect between what he wants and what the rest of the caucus wants, and some political hiccups if he tried to do that. A leader, a governor who had a kind of strength, would push this, right, and just do it. And I don't know what it would be or what will gain consensus, but a leader and a governor who wants to push this on the agenda can do so pretty effectively. We saw Rick Perry do this for years. So to me, he could do more. I also think that a couple of things, that the study itself, although it had some things that would definitely reach consensus, I think there's no doubt, there's some things on there that maybe weren't part of that story that a lot of people think could be or should be. First, there was no discussion about bump stocks, right, and banning those. There was also no discussion about background checks or increasing the ability for people to show that they were able to competently have a firearm. I want to read you a headline, too, from one of them. Here is the example of the tepidness of this. Here, in quotes, to study a protective order law to keep guns out of the hands of those mentally unfit to bear arms, but only after legal due process is allowed to ensure Second Amendment rights are not violated. There's a lot of hedging there. And to me, if a governor wanted to make this happen, they could. I think he could make it happen, almost all these things. But the kind of, you know, between position of I'll do it if doesn't give him that moral authority. And I think politically probably doesn't give him the full impact of what it will otherwise, I think, be a really effective tool.
But I guess I'm looking at it from the perspective, this is sort of a classic Greg Abbott maneuver,
yes,
right? You put out something that has some popularity that could, as you said, could be passed and probably would be passed. But you're holding back because you are unbelievably politically cautious. Right, because the worst thing for him is
to the point of paralysis to some degree, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I think he gets out there and he doesn't want to push something aggressively. because of fear of losing, because we saw that in the last special session. He came out there with a whole series of bills, 22 items in a special session, got maybe half of them or fewer.
And was okay with it.
And
right?
was okay. Yeah, he declared a win.
Yeah, declared victory
right,
after.
Right.
Yeah,
now, this coming off of a tragedy, if he calls a special session only on these specific items, huge problem for him if he falls short.
Yeah.
And so I think that's a political gamble he doesn't want to take. I'm suggesting that he should and be bold and be strong. And I think from a pure politics perspective for him, it would dominate any discussion about anything else.
I agree.
And maybe that's what he doesn't want.
Yeah.
He doesn't want the rest of the summer and going into the fall to be talking about this issue.
Yeah, because you're right. If there's political friction, it makes it look like he's lost control of the caucus even more than he probably already has. It also will get bogged down into questions about the liberty issues at stake, right? Who's required to do what when with firearms? And the pay issue, right? Where is the money going to come from for all these different programs? That is going to be something that I think literally is difficult to find in a tight budget, but also is going to be troublesome to find consensus.
Well, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to tell you whether we think this actually goes anywhere, whether it's in a special session or the next session.
So, Jay, we hashed out a couple of the political issues and talked about the ramifications of the policy issues. What do you think is going to happen with respect to Greg Abbott's school safety plan?
Well, as much as I'd like there to be a special session, I don't think the governor is going to call it, not because he's not in favor of what he's put out there, but I think it's because he really wants the politics of it to be defined on his terms because he's running for re-election. I think you'll have a special session. A lot of these items will be passed, but the bulk of them probably not.
You know, I think that this is a good start in the direction of finding some bipartisan consensus, and the fact that they can work together on some of these things to start is good. To me, though, this doesn't really address the gun issue, right? This addresses a school safety issue. So it could be that somebody is like attacking with a knife or a weed whacker, right? Like those things are all going to be covered by this. This is not a gun issue per se, and I think that he could take some heat over that. So it wouldn't solve like the larger problem as suggested by Dan Patrick, right? The kind of lack of culture of life, or like Sutherland Springs kind of problem, right? So it is a very narrow problem. Obviously, the governor can kind of aim small, miss small here, right? Really keep it tight and organized. And I think that for him, that's probably a win. And ultimately, he's going to get a lot of this, but I don't think it'll be soon.
Well, that's it for this week. Party Politics is recorded in the George B. Geary Performance Studio at Houston Public Media.
Big thanks to our executive producer, Don Geraci, who always makes sure we have ballot access. Special kudos to our web team, Giselle Bueno and Matt Prendergast, and to our graphics guru, Michelle Lamb. And finally, thanks to our audio engineer, Todd Zero Tolerance Holstlander.
I'm Jay Iyer.
And I'm Brandon Roddinghouse. We'll see you next week.